Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now, Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they're in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord said to him, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. The word of the Lord.
Envy. In its simplest form, envy says this: I want what you have, and I don't want you to have it. Envy is covetousness's more evil cousin. Covetousness says, "I want what you have." And then envy adds, "And I don't want you to have it." In other words, envy perceives a good that another person has and doesn't want them to have that good anymore, or a good that you have, because somehow their having that good diminishes your having that same good. I want what you have, and I don't want you to have it. Or in an anticipatory form, I have something and I don't want you to get it. Because the moment you get it too, and we both have this same thing, somehow or other I'm diminished. It is the turning point of the story of Cain and Abel, where Cain sees that Abel has something that he wants, God's favor, the knowledge of how to give a proper sacrifice, and he doesn't want Abel to have it. And so he cuts Abel off. The nature of shame is really well illustrated in the modification of a joke I once heard. It's not really a joke, actually. It's kind of a parable. A man dies, and he goes to hell. His fate has not yet been determined, but the devil has been granted to give him a tour of hell, one of its rooms. And in this room, he sees that there's three large pots or cauldrons filled with hot pitch. And the devil takes him around to see what's in these large cauldrons. And in the first cauldron, he looks in and he sees a bunch of kind of grayish people that are screaming out in fear and scrambling over top of each other and trying to get out of the cauldron. And little devils around the edge of the cauldron just poke them back in. And the man asks the devil, "Well, who are these in this pot?" And the man said, and the devil says to the man, "Well, these are the cowardly in this cauldron." And then the man is taken to a second pot, and there's it's a bigger pot and there's more people in it, and they're cherry hot red and they're yelling at each other and punching each other in the face and kicking each other and all trying to get out of the cauldron at the same time. And the man asks the devil, who are in these cauldrons? And he says, oh, these are those who are filled with wrath. And then the devil takes him to the third cauldron, which is far larger, far filled with far more people. And the man looks in, and the first thing he notices is that there's no little devils anywhere who are pitchforking them back in, as in the other two cauldrons. But instead, what he sees is that these people are green. And when one of them swims up high enough and catches the edge and is about to pull themselves up and out of the cauldron, you don't need little devils because he pulls them back in. The others in the pot, in the cauldron, pull them back in to the hot pitch. And the man asks, who are these? And the devil says, those. Well, those are the envious. I want what you have, escape, and I don't want you to have it. Envy is positively deadly, and it's got malice at its core. Resentment for other people. And unfortunately, sisters and brothers, envy is a human universal. Because we participate in the fall, because we participate in the revolt of Adam and Eve, we are born predisposed to envy, to saying, in many different ways, both subtle and not so subtle, I want what you have, and I don't want you have it. Or, I have something, and woe betide me if you get it too. It happens among the old, it happens among the middle-aged, and it also happens among the young. Psychologists ran an experiment where they put two or three-year-old in a room filled with toys, all of the newest toys on the block. Tons of duplicates of these toys were in the room. The child was perfectly fine enjoying the toys until another child is introduced into the room. And then somehow something clicks in the child's soul, and he goes over to the other child, and we might even see it in Sunday in our own nursery sometimes here, right? The child goes over to the other child and wants that particular toy that that child has. Suddenly becomes unhappy that the other child has something that he wants, doesn't want him to have it. It's a classic stage of envy. Envy is something that happens to people every single day all around the globe in the workplace. A journalist, for example, gets praised by the general editor for an excellent article that they produced, a wonderful news piece. A colleague overhears their colleague getting praised for it, and they suddenly wish that their colleague would walk outside and maybe get hit by a car or drop dead or at least boff the next article, thank you very much. It's envy. Rebecca Canondike DeYoung, I think, ingeniously points out that the tension that pushes the plot line of the story Amadeus along is the theme of envy. Amadeus is the story of Wolfgang Amadeus's life, but not only his life, it's also the life of a guy called Salieri, whom most of us probably haven't even heard of. Salieri was an upright, God-loving, chaste composer who worked his whole life feverishly, tirelessly to be the best composer in the world. And he composed a lot of music. And then a brat, an immoral chap who had a very annoying laugh comes along, who also happens to be supernaturally gifted, whose name is Mozart. And Salieri absolutely hates him for it and comforts himself by plotting Amadeus' death, which is what happens. Envy, sisters and brothers, is indeed a deadly, deadly vice. And it's one of the reasons that we need to do all that we can as the children of God to kill this green monster or this dragon, as we've been talking about over the past several weeks. We need to kill it. I know of no better text in Scripture to help us do this and to give us an insight into the depths of what envy really is, where it comes from, what kind of things contribute to it, than Genesis chapter 4. It is positively unbelievable the amount of insight that is packed into these short few verses, which make this story, I think you will see, quite archetypal. It shows us what's true of each one of us. So it has a historical dimension, but it also has a dimension where it's talking about each and every one of us. And in particular, I believe it profiles what has been defined as envy. Again, as last week, the word doesn't come up in this text, but the content of what envy really is and why we become envious is all here. So spend a little bit of time, first of all, just looking at what envy is, according to Genesis 4, 1 through 16, and then in conclusion, just look at, okay, so how can we kill this beast? How can we kill this green monster in our lives? The first thing we need to do is to look at context. You'll notice that in the first verse of our text, Adam and Eve are mentioned in the first two verses. Immediately after chapter 4, which is, you get to chapter 5, and there's going to be a genealogy where Adam is again mentioned, and in particular, that he is made in the image of God. I think that is, when we look at the context, the particularly salient piece of information, because remember where we're coming from. Human beings, according to the narrative scripture, are created with unmatched dignity among the creatures of the creation. Why? Because they're created in the image of God. Or, as we might put it, they are created as God's idols, his statues in the round. Within the ancient Near East, an idol was something that you put at the heart and center of the God's temple. And it was to be the avatar of the God. It was to be the embodiment in the earthly sphere of the God's presence. And the word for that is glory. The visible manifestation of the God's presence in the earthly realm is typified by the word glory. It's brilliant. It's iridescent. It is the presence of the God. Now, this is the dignity that both men and women are given within the book of Genesis. We're the image bearers of God, the likeness of God, the statue in the round idol of God. But what happens? Well, when Adam and Eve revolt against God, as we see, it's as though they were wearing a garment. This is how Second Temple Jewish literature understands it, and it's picked up in the New Testament. So I think it's fair to read it back. And actually, we see it here. I think it would have been read in originally. But it's like Adam and Eve, in their native state before the fall, were wearing garments of glory. And when they rebel against God, it's as though the garment of glory is stripped off of them, and they are naked. In other words, they don't know their worth anymore. They don't know where their identity truly rests, what gives them dignity, what gives them honor. And so no wonder they're afraid when God comes, because they recognize themselves as threadbare in their identity now. It's not just a physical nakedness. It is that, sure, but I think that would be a far too literal rendering of the text. Something far deeper is going on here, and it's that they're stripped of their glory. What does God do after that? Before they're kicked out of the garden, which is a place of glory, right? So they're filled with glory, that glory departs. They live within a place of glory, and they're going to be kicked out. But what does God do first? This is critically important. There's a sacrifice. And God provides for Adam and Eve's shame. He covers them with a coat. And I think it's highly symbolically important, because here's the question we come to at the end of Genesis 3. Will Adam and Eve trust in the Lord for their identity, for their self-worth? In other words, will they trust him to provide for them what they need most, to give them glory once again? Or will they try to find an identity and build up their self-worth on their own without God? As we talked about last week, it's the pride of identity that comes along with the pride of life and an intellectual pride or the pride of knowledge. Will they trust God for their identity? Okay, so here we come to Genesis chapter 4, and the answer we get in Genesis 4, beloved of God, is no. One of the biggest struggles we human beings are going to have is to trust God to give us an identity. To trust God with our value and self-worth. We see it first with Eve, and then we see it second of all with Cain. Where is Eve going to find her identity? Well, she's going to find her identity, according to Genesis 4, 1 and 2, in a power that is resident within her that is positively miraculous, in her ability to bring forth life into the world, in her childbearing capacities. It's kind of heady. In Genesis chapter 2, God, with all his divine power, brings woman out of man. And now, woman is going to find that she is this godlike power in herself to bring man out of woman. It's unbelievable. And you'll say, looking at your NIV translations, but where do you see this? Where do you see that this is where Eve finds her identity? And it's like this. In the Hebrew original, it seems very apparent that Eve boasts about the fact that she is able to bring forth a man. In the NIV, it says this: with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth men. That is nowhere in the Hebrew. And as Hebrew commentators are now saying, it's nowhere in the Hebrew. Actually, what you have there is Eve saying, after giving birth to Cain, I got me a man in the presence or from beside the Lord. It's boasting. She's bragging about the native power within her to bring forth life. Another clue that this is what's going on is in a wordplay, a pun in the Hebrew. Cain's name, Cain, is matched with I got me, which is Kana. Cain, Kana. And then the word means the same. Cain means got, acquired, get. And Kana means got, acquired, get. I got me, got. I acquired me, acquired. I kanad me, Cain. She boasts. Eve's identity is in her capacity to bring forth life into the world. You want another tidbit of evidence that this is probably what's going on in this archetypal story? Look at the rest of Genesis. This is a theme that you see not only through the rest of Genesis. Remember the pregnancy wars between Rebecca and Leah, who are also tempted to believe that their identity as women is going to come in having children? But then it proceeds throughout the Old Testament. It's very tempting for women in that context to believe that their identity, their value, their self-worth comes in their capacity to bear children. And Jesus is going to say, no, no, no. Your value can be in your work for the kingdom. And Jesus is going to be a watershed moment in the history, probably of the world, if not just Israel. But it is there. That's where Eve finds it. Cain, of course, is not going to find his identity in bringing forth children into the world, although I'd have to modify that. We could look at that another time. But in particular, Cain does this. He's going to try and construct his own identity. He's not going to trust God for his self-worth and dignity. He's going to find it on his own. But how? Like this. Cain is going to live in the mode of comparison, which will, given the right circumstances, become a mode of competition. So Cain is going to have a couple of rules that he lives by, which if he can check the boxes off, he's going to say, okay, I feel okay with myself. And here's what he says to himself. Here's a script that he lives by, okay? I am okay, I have self-worth, I have an identity, as long as I am sufficiently different from people, especially those who are closest to me, and as long, if I can't be different from people who are close to me, at least I can be better than them. Cain, in order to have an identity, needs to be sufficiently different from people. It's like a cult of uniqueness, if you will, and he needs to be, if he can't be different, he at least needs to be better. This is articulated in our text. It's demonstrated in our text. One of the things our author does, notice as you look at this text, is he delineates the differences and emphasizes the differences between Cain and Abel from start to finish. Everything about them is different. Cain is older, Abel is younger. Cain is named by mom, Abel is not. Cain is celebrated, Abel is not. Cain is a farmer, Abel is a shepherd. Cain sacrifices fruits from the soil, Abel first fruits from his flock. Everything about them is different. And it may just be at one point in time, Cain and Abel kind of came to this unspoken agreement. Hey, man, we'll be okay as long as if you go left, I go right. If you go up, I go down. If you paint yourself blue, I've got to be green. Haven't you seen this in families with close siblings before, too? By the way, sometimes I'll hear it among little kids. Well, if you, my sister, are going to be a teacher, then I am going to be a lawyer. But if you're going to be a lawyer, then I'm going to be... We have to be different. We want to be unique. And if we can't be different, then we'll at least be better. Look at where things start to go wrong. Look at where the wheels fall off in our story. Everything's fine according to our text. Until when? Until Cain and Abel find themselves doing the same thing, and his pesky little brother Abel does it better. Uh-oh. Cain's identity script is interrupted. He's no longer different. They're doing the same thing. And goodness gracious me, he's no longer better either, because Abel has gained the favor of God and Cain hasn't. And it's a huge problem. There's also an indication in the text that it's a bit worse. The screw goes a little deeper, because it looks maybe like Cain was the first to figure out that sacrifice was a good thing, and then Abel copies him, and then Abel outshines him. Ooh, right? Isn't that chafing? And like a lava in a volcano that's heated up, envy begins to boil up within Cain. He feels it, and it's not a good feeling.